privilege to be here with all of you tonight. Some devotees requested me to speak about my spiritual quest and how I ultimately came to Srila Prabhupada. And in obedience to their command, I shall do so. I'll start with high school. I mean, one could begin this narration from earlier, but for the sake of time, I'll begin with high school. So by the time I reached high school, I was looking, I wanted to help people. That was one of my main concerns. How to help people. And at that time, I thought of helping people in terms of their physical diseases. My uncle was a medical doctor, and I had tremendous admiration for him. And so in high school, I became the president of something like the Future Doctors Association. But when I got to college, I found that there were people who were suffering not from physical ailments, but from mental disturbances. And I found that their suffering could be greater even than the suffering caused by physical illnesses, at least the ones I had seen until then. I had one friend who, in retrospect, I think might have been depressed, but he would, you know, he would just throw himself on his bed in the dormitory room, and he just wasn't interested in anything. And at that time, I had the idea that love, well, there's like parallel tracks to this story. One is my own search for perfection, and the other is my desire to help others. So coming back to my own search for perfection, in high school, I read a book called The Art of Loving by Eric Fromm, and he described love as a process, not as just a feeling. And, you know, in conjunction with other books, I came to the conclusion that the perfection was love. And so in college, I thought, well, you know, I love this boy, and you know, I thought that love would prevail. But I found that he was not ready to or able to appreciate my care for him. He wasn't able to perceive it, even to accept it. And then I realized it wasn't so simple as I had thought. And at that time, Brandeis University had a very progressive department of psychology under the chairmanship of Abraham Maslow. And up until then, there had been two main schools of psychology. One was behaviorism, and a prominent figure in that field was B.F. Skinner. And they studied rats, mainly. And the other school was psychoanalysis, which was founded by Sigmund Freud, and they studied basically diseased persons. So Maslow and others had the idea, why not study healthy people? And so he developed what was called a third force in psychology. And he undertook a study of healthy people. And he found that there is a hierarchy of needs, that we begin with basic needs for physical survival. And gradually we come to a higher order of needs, including what he called self-actualization, and then self-realization or self-actualization. And that on that level, the subjects that he studied had what he called peak experiences, which is an experience of unity, of oneness and peace. So this was very promising. But then I found that within the Department of Psychology, there was a lot of vying for position and vying for allotments of the department's budget, and all sorts of politics. So I thought, well, maybe this isn't exactly the complete solution. But one thing about the department is that it invited many guest speakers. And by this time, I had been reading, and my goal was perfect happiness, and I have concluded that there's no perfect happiness in material life, so I must find another approach to perfect happiness. And through reading different books, I concluded that to be successful in my attempt or my pursuit, I needed a guru, or a teacher. So then my quest became focused on finding my guru. And reading so many books, I came to the conclusion that we don't exactly choose our guru, but our guru is already there, and we just have to find him. So during those years, I would go to hear any guru, or so-called gurus, anywhere within 1,000 miles. And I met many. There was a many famous ones, or the popular ones that I'm sure you've heard of. But I'll see if I can tell the story without mentioning their names. Anyway, after meeting a number, and a number of them were invited to the university campus by the Department of Psychology to give talks. So one was it's very hard to tell the story without mentioning the name, because it's too vague and too one was J. Krishnamurti, and he gave a morning and an evening seminar, and I remember the room was packed. And I had one professor of psychology named James Clee, who had been to India, and he invited many of these speakers, including J. Krishnamurti. So I wanted to meet him and speak with him. But the room in the morning session was very packed. And so in the intermission, I asked Professor Klee if I could meet Mr. Krishnamurti. And he said, "Why do you want to meet him?" I said, I'm looking for a guru, and I want to see if he might be the one. He said, "Oh no, he doesn't accept disciples. He doesn't even accept money." I thought, you know, if he has knowledge that can help someone, why should he refuse? Why should he have some conception that he won't accept disciples if he could do that and help people? But this seems to be like he's putting more importance on being renounced than on helping people. So I thought, well, he's not my perfect master. So then a famous Hatha yogi from New York City came up, and he gave a talk in the auditorium. And one thing that really struck me in the talk was that he described that by yoga you could gain mastery over your involuntary muscular system, including your intestines. And he said that by yoga, you can direct your intestines, something like that, the type of thing, say right vertical colon advance and transverse colon advance and descending colon advance and rectum release. So I was very impressed, but still I thought, what does this have to do with self-realization? But I wasn't, you know, I was so eager to find my guru that I didn't give up on anyone. Afterwards I said I would like to speak with the Swami. And, you know, the authorities said, well, he's going to the airport, straight from the campus. Can I ride with him? No, you can't ride with him, the car is full. But you can ride with some of his disciples who are going to the airport. So I got in the car with the disciples, and they were talking about all the types of food they missed since they joined the ashram. So I thought, wow, you know, they were just with their master and just gave a lecture, and they're just talking about all the food they missed, like pizza. And nothing against pizza. But I was thinking, that seems odd. And then I thought, well, they're just the students. You really can't say for sure based on the students. So let me see this one. So we got to the airport, and you know, we went to the departure lounge to the gate. That was before there were all the restrictions. And the Swami, he was the picture of Indian spirituality. Long hair, long hair, long beard, and flowing orange robes, and a beatific smile, and a twinkle in his eyes. And there he was at the airport, very warmly and tightly embracing a female disciple, I guess. And I thought, he may not be my perfect master. So then, I heard of a Zen master who was certified as an enlightened Zen master by another Zen master in Japan who had been certified as an enlightened master. And I had read his book, so I went to him. So he was offering like a weekend, you know, 3-day introductory retreat. So I drove to his ashram in Rochester, New York. And they had us, I might as well say from the beginning. So, you know, I rang the bell, someone opened the door. They didn't seem very cheerful. They looked a bit glum. But again, you know, I didn't want to come to any premature conclusion or pass any judgment. So then, you know, there was some introductory talk, and we were asked to sit cross-legged facing the wall. And we were given maybe a Zen koan, a sort of riddle that is impossible for the material, logical mind to solve. Like, you know, what is the sound of one hand clapping? And the Zen master, he would go around the room behind us, because everyone was facing the wall. And if he detected that you were slackening in your efforts or that your mind was wandering, he'd give you a tap on the shoulder with his stick. So, I was open, but wasn't going that well. So then there was a break for lunch, and they had, you know, like wooden tables and wooden benches, and the Zen master was sitting right with everyone, and so I sat at the same table with him, and I heard one of the disciples, comment about some behavior of the master, or misbehavior. And the master said, "Well, that's true. I shouldn't have lost my temper. But I had read that enlightened Zen practitioners, or enlightened Zen masters, can appear very ordinary. So I thought, well, this might just be part of it, that he seems to be ordinary. So I reserved judgment. But I had my doubts, and overall, the students seemed sort of subdued. But again, I thought, well, they're just the students. I can't really say for sure based on that. But on the face of it, I didn't think that he was my perfect master. So it just so happened, very soon after that, Professor Houston Smith at MIT invited the same Zen master to speak. And I went. And someone asked him about Vedanta. And he replied, "I have enough trouble keeping up with Zen. Don't ask me about Vedanta." And then I thought, he's not my perfect master. So then, oh boy. we can't touch on all of them because there are too many. But then I heard, this is sort of a turning point. Then I heard that there was a professor of psychology at Antioch University in Ohio who was supposed to be an enlightened soul. So as soon as, my class is finished on Friday, or maybe even after my last class on Thursday, I left early Friday morning, great eagerness and expectations, rushed to the professor's office, just reached before noon. I met his secretary and said that I want to meet the professor. And she said, "He's playing golf." And I looked like, I didn't say anything, but I think from my expression she could see that I was thinking, what is this? I thought he was an enlightened soul. I didn't say anything, and she said, "That's his Zen." So I thought, this is not my perfect master. But I'd driven all that way, so I went to the student union, the cafeteria, and it turns out that there had been a Swami from India who had visited the campus just a week earlier, some number of days earlier. And the last three syllables of his name were Ananda. And that's all I caught or could remember. I could never figure out who it was. There are a lot of Swamis whose names end with Ananda. But they said that he had told them that God is in your heart. He's sitting on the lotus of your heart. And he can talk to you. And this was a stunning revelation. Because this was the first time that I'd heard of God spoken of as a person, as someone who has the attributes of a person, and he's sitting in your heart. He is sitting in your heart, and he can talk to you. So I thought about that, and thought about that, and thought about that, and that really was very encouraging, but I didn't know where to go from there. Now, somehow in my mind, I had an impression of what my guru looked like. A very vague impression. And he didn't have head. And all the other swamis I had seen had hair, long hair. So I was, you know, like so many. I have so many, and I didn't find my perfect master. And then on top of it, I sensed that he had no hair, and all the other swamis had long hair. So I was so discouraged and dejected, I become hopeless. I'm never going to find my perfect master. So then, one day on campus, I saw a poster. Bhagavad Gita as it is. Swami Bhakti Vedanta, such and such law. But by then I was so discouraged I hardly even paid notice. So that night, by then I was a vegetarian, I was already a vegetarian, so I invited my friends over, my closest friends, for dinner, salad and pasta, and then we were going to go to a movie in Harvard Square. Those were the days of art houses, so there was a movie by a Japanese director who was my favorite, and we were going to go. But as we were getting ready, I kept like seeing that poster in my mind. And I brought it up to my friends, you know, there's a lecture on campus tonight. Why don't we come to see that? Why don't we go to hear that lecture? No, we already decided we're going to the movie. And, you know, I was the type I'd like to sort of please people. And I didn't want to displease them. So, okay. I wanted to go along with what they wanted. But something inside of me kept forcing me, you must go to the lecture. So I said, no, let's go to the lecture. And then we'll go to the movie. We'll go to the late show. So, yeah. And then one of the friends, a lady friend, she got really upset. I mean, really upset. And she was almost screaming it. Like, why do you always have to be running after these swamis and yogis? Why can't you be like other people? But she was screaming. And I just shouted back, okay! This will be the last one I ever go to. So, that turned out to be true. So we went to the auditorium, and because of all this discussion, we were late, but there was kirtan going on. And Srila Prabhupada was on the stage, and the disciples were dancing in a circle on the stage. And the auditorium had bare brick walls. It's sort of modern. And the sound was reverberating off of the walls. And the students, like one by one, they were jumping up out of their chairs and climbing up onto the stage and joining the chanting and dancing. And that's what I felt like doing. So I stood up. And there was like, you know, all my friends. And I thought, you know, if I do this, that'll probably just be the end. It'll be too much. They just won't be able to take it. So I just stood up at my place, and I was like, you know, swaying back and forth and chanting. So then at the end of the kirtan, one of the devotees announced that if anyone has a car and is driving to Harvard Square or Boston, please meet us in the lobby of the auditorium because we need a ride. The devotees didn't have any motor vehicle stuff. So I went. And the first devotee I met is named Bharadraj Das. And anyway, that was also a memorable exchange. But so then I said, I have a station wagon. We're going to Harvard Square. You can come with me. So they all piled in. I don't even know how they all sit. And so at that time, my best friend's name, his name was Gary. So he was in the far back compartment with Satsvarupa. And I think there were only two women. So I was the driver, and then my lady friend and the other lady, Janava, they were in the front seat. So in the back, from the very back, I heard my friend Gary say that everything is ultimately void. And I heard Satsvarupa say, there is no void in the creation of God. So they were arguing. And from my position in the front seat, being a little proud, I thought, oh, I have to answer. So I turned around and quoted something I'd read in books, that it's not void, and it's not not void. But to give it a name, we call it void. Well, that profound jewel of wisdom had absolutely no effect. And they kept on arguing. So I thought, okay, let them argue. So I had my question. I was just like so eager to ask. So I asked the lady, the front seat, Janava, about, I asked about Yogananda, because I read a lot of biography of a yogi. And she said, oh, Yogananda, he's just a shopkeeper. Whatever you want, he keeps it in stock. You want yoga, he gives you yoga. You want this, he gives you that. You want Ganesh, you get it back. You want Durga? Wow, okay. And if you ever go to his ashram, he has a shrine to Mahatma Gandhi, in which he describes Mahatma Gandhi as a worker for world peace. He wasn't a worker for world peace, he was working for India's political independence. He doesn't even know who Mahatma Gandhi is. Oh, wow. And then I asked about Zen. And she said, this world is like images on a movie screen. And if you draw your consciousness back from the screen, you'll see there's light. And if you follow that light back far enough, it comes to a point, sort of like that's the void. But beyond the point, there's a light bulb. And beyond the light bulb, there's a machine. And beyond the machine, there's an operator of the machine. And I thought, wow, this is the most beautiful explanation I've ever heard. It describes Zen, it goes beyond it. I thought, this is amazing. This the knowledge that this lady has and the conviction that she has is astonishing. But I sense it couldn't just be coming from her. It must be coming from someone else. To her and from her to me. So we got to Harvard Square and I let them out. And then I realized, I don't know how to find them. I don't know where their ashram is. So I parked the car, jumped out, caught up with the devotees. The last devotee, you know, as the group was walking away, was Pratik Pavan Das. And, you know, he looked at me and he said, just see all these people. They're like sleepwalkers. They don't even know who they are or what they're doing or where they're going. It's like everything that the devotees were saying was so captivating. I was just listening. And then suddenly my thoughts were interrupted by the sound of honking horns. And, oh my God, I left the car at the intersection. And I looked, I saw all these angry motorists honking their horns waiting for that Red Rambler station wagon to move. So I said, quick, you know, give me the address, give me the address. So then the next night I went to the temple. And Srila Prabhupada was speaking. I didn't understand everything, partly because of his accent and partly because it was a different type of talk. But I did hear him say something that struck me. He said, and he was quoting a verse from the Bhagavad Gita, that out of many thousands of persons, one will seek perfection. And out of many perfected beings, hardly one will know Krishna. So that first part, out of many thousands of men, one will seek perfection. I thought, that's me. He's talking about me. So after the talk, I asked the question that was like consuming me. And I said, there's so many swamis and yogis. And each one advocates a different method of self-realization. And each one says that his is best. So how do I know which is actually best? And he replied very intelligently, what is your goal? Because I'm asking what is the best means. And he asked, well, what is the end that you're pursuing? And then according to the end, you can consider what is the best means. And I didn't even know what to say. And he said, do you want to serve God? Or do you want to become God? And he said, if you want to become God, it means you're not God now. And how can not God become God? God is God. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God by yoga or meditation. And then he said, Krishna is God. He's God when he's playing on the lap of Mother Yashoda. He's God when he's walking in the hallways of Dwarka. He's God when he's speaking the Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. He's always God. He doesn't have to become God. yoga or meditation. And then he said, if you want to serve God, God is in your heart. It's like what the other Swami said at India. God is in your heart, and He is ready to help you. But if you want to become God, you're only cheating yourself. Why should God help the competition? And he said, if you sow the seed of service to God and water it with chanting, then God will give you all the sunlight and all the favorable conditions to make that service grow. So he said, you can become godly, but you cannot become God. So what do you think, Jesse? You want to serve God, or do you want to become God? So by then I understood the futility of trying to become God. But at the same time, I knew that Srila Prabhupada, or I sensed that Srila Prabhupada knew everything, and I couldn't really cheat him. I had the sense that he was looking right into me, like seeing through me, seeing through the walls of the temple, seeing through the area back all the way to my apartment where I lived. And then he was seeing right into my apartment, right into my bathroom, where on the wall I had inscribed in my own hand very ornate, colorful writing, a sign which I put up on the wall, "You are God," just to remind me, in case I forgot. So I sensed that Srila Prabhupada was seeing this. So when he asked me, "Do you want to serve God or do you want to become God?" I began by saying, "I want to serve God." Because that's what I had just heard and that's what I had understood. But I realized actually, when I asked the question, I had the idea that, yeah, I wanted to become God. So I said, "I want to serve God," but actually I realized that I wanted to become God. He said, "Yes." So then I knew it. I had found my perfect master, and I bowed down in submission, and from then on, there were many details how I gradually came to dedicate myself more fully. But from that moment, I knew that I had found my perfect master. So I thought, this is it. But then, about a week or 10 days later, I saw there was like a lot of activity at the temple. So I asked, "What's happening? What's all the excitement?" And they said, "Srila Prabhupada is leaving." "Leaving? Where is he going?" And they said, "Well, he has many centers, and he's going to Columbus, Ohio." I didn't realize that. They said, "You want to come to the airport with us?" "Yes." So at the airport, I saw that all the devotees were crying. They weren't sad, exactly, but they were just crying. So I asked this other devotee, Arundhati, why are they crying? I thought, maybe, up until then I thought everything is perfect. The philosophy is perfect, the chanting is perfect, the food is perfect. I love the association of the devotees. I thought everything is perfect. Maybe this is the defect that the spiritual master has to leave. So she replied that Srila Prabhupada said that on the absolute platform, meeting and separation are the same. Both are occasions of ecstasy. So I thought, that's a perfect answer. But still there was a doubt whether it was practical, but it did sound just right. So, and then, maybe 3 weeks later, we were chanting Hare Krishna on the streets in front of the Kalpi Square train station. And I suddenly felt Srila Prabhupada's presence descend upon me. And it was so tangible. I just felt that he was there. I knew that he was there. And I also became emotional. I also began to believe it. And then I thought, yes, it's true. The Prabhupada said it's true, that she had told me. It's true that on the absolute platform there's no difference between separation and meeting. Both are occasions of ecstasy. So during Srila Prabhupada's presence, my main goal, in a way, was at a certain stage, I just wanted to bring people to Srila Prabhupada. And after he left physically, I thought, now how will I do that? But I thought of that instruction and that experience I had, and I thought it is possible that Srila Prabhupada is present, and by reading his books, especially by reading his books, chanting Hare Krishna, following the process of Bhakti Yoga that he explained, and serving him, serving his ideals, one can experience his presence. And so I feel even now I can bring people to Srila Prabhupada. And there are many other incidents that I wish I could share with you, but we don't have time. I think I will tell this last one. This was when Srila Prabhupada was still in Boston. And he had a program at, I believe it was Boston College, definitely one of the universities in Boston. And, you know, he was sitting on a dais and he spoke beautifully, and there were wonderful questions and answers. And afterwards, there was chanting. And in this particular arrangement in the room, the dais was in the back, and then there was like an open area, and the devotees were chanting in a circle, and then behind the open area there were chairs where the students and the staff were sitting. So as I was dancing in the circle and chanting, I felt my heart filled with love for all the people in the room. I never had such an experience. And as we were going around in the circle, I would look at their faces and I felt so much love for them. And then that feeling of love expanded, as if it was expanding beyond the walls of the classroom, beyond the Boston area, across the United States, across the Pacific, and up throughout the universe. It's the sense of universal love. Probably there was a little voice in my mind, are you having a peak experience? But it was that was minor, but it was an overwhelming experience. And afterwards, and up until then, I had asked questions, but I never really approached the problem directly. And afterwards, I just couldn't contain myself. And I went up to him, where he was sitting, and I was just there. And I said, Srila Prabhupada, this chanting is amazing. And he looked at me and he started to chuckle. His whole body was heaving. And I knew he wasn't laughing at me. I knew that he was feeling transcendental ecstasy, because this young boy had gotten a drop of the taste and the effects of the chanting. His body was heaving and he was chuckling, and his eyes had tears. They often did, maybe all the time, tears of love for Krishna. And he smiled at me with great love and compassion and ecstasy, and said, thank you very much. And as one devotee commented later, that he gives you the most precious gift, and then he thanks you for accepting it. So thank you for coming and listening.